Welcome to Positive Personal Power with hope, aspiration, and encouragement. Our goal is to build and enhance people's confidence and strength to handle life's challenges. Now, let me introduce you to your host, Nathaniel Skula.
Thankfully, Mike Tobin has managed to bring in Stanley Tucci, right? Is that how it's pronounced?
Tucci, yes.
Super. Yeah. And I'm quite interested in what you do and what you have done, because my sister actually is based over in Hollywood. She lives there. She's been doing voiceovers, bit of producing and acting right. for, you know, since she was a little kid. And it's tough, really. It's you know, hats off to you to get make some success from that. It's
quite a bit of success, I'd say, considering
big success.
We were counting the other day in preparation for something else you're doing with us, Stan.
Yes.
We got to about 92 different films that you've made and gave up. we said, why don't you just say quite a lot?
Let's just say too many.
It's a fantastic career. Fantastic.
Oh, it's great. You know, it's great. It's still no matter where you are, I mean, you know, you're still always struggling to get things that you'd like to get that aren't coming your way, or to get your own projects off the ground and all that stuff. It's always a bit of a struggle, because it's a very fickle business. Mm. And it's ever changing, you know. And it's changing. It's changing so quickly now, with streaming services. It's kind of wonderful that the way it's changing to me, because there are so many more options out there, and a lot of the old models are being thrown out of the window. And for instance, trying to get, let's say, an independent movie made, and I made quite a few independent movies as an actor, and I've directed 5 of my own independent films. It's a real struggle. It can take years and years and years and years, and then the movie will come out and it'll be distributed in a handful of theaters usually, and then it disappears, and it has a longer life. It used to have a longer life on DVD, but now it's, you know, ends up on Netflix or wherever it ends up. And that's great. But now, you don't have to do that route anymore. And I'm sad to say it, that, you know, I don't know how much longer we're going to be going to movie theaters. Mm. I love going to movie theaters, but it's more often than not that I watch a movie here. And if you're making a small independent movie and it's made by one of these streaming services, Apple, Netflix, you know, whatever, HBO, whatever, you have the built-in audience. Mm. And it's kind of amazing. So you're able to get your product, your picture out there as never before. And you don't have to go through all that rigmarole of, oh, it didn't open on the weekend, boom, you're out of the theater.
Yeah, I guess in a way it's kind of lower risk, right? Because once you've got this, you know, the signature that you're going to do the thing and it's funded, then you don't have to worry about kind of, you know, is it going to make the card? Is it, you know, when are they going to release it? You know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to go through the rigmarole of sort of going from city to city, showing up at theaters, you know, doing talks and all that sort of stuff, which is fine. But the amount of effort and time that it takes to promote a movie that already took a huge amount of time and effort to make.
Yeah,
it's exhausting. And then, like I said, it'll show for, you know, a couple of weeks and see you later.
Yeah.
So I think the way things are changing now is it's actually pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I did an interview the other day for my other show with a friend of mine. He's EVP for a movie production company. It was very interesting talking about media and you know, the new streaming and all that kind of stuff. It's very interesting. But like the journey that you guys go on as actors is very similar to like the entrepreneurial journey of almost banging your head on a wall for years to try and make something work. And then eventually you change a little bit and you find some success, right? So I know Mike said I haven't got any questions, but I do like to, I like to have a few, you know, I like to have a few, right? And because this show is all about, it's about breaking through struggles in life, right? And helping people who, helping the listeners to maybe take away some insights, right? So what do you think the biggest struggles you've been through are in your career?
I think the hardest thing originally when I first started, well, sometimes the biggest struggle is against yourself. That's the first struggle. And the struggle against yourself is often taking yourself too seriously. And if you take yourself too seriously, you're never going to be able to achieve the kind of ease necessary that comes with that will bring success and will also bring joy to you. So once I learned not to take myself so seriously, things got easier to a certain extent. But I think the primary sort of external obstacle was typecasting. And being of Italian descent, so I started in this business we call show in 1982, right out of college. And I look Italian, I am Italian. And at that time, Italians were really portrayed only as mafiosi. So inevitably I played the bad guy. You always were cast as the mafioso or the villain or the whatever, or the punk and the thing. And the, you know, there was, you know, it was like, you know, and it wasn't really until I got, and then I, you know, you do that first to a certain extent for a while, or even if you were playing like a cop, you became the bad cop. There was something, because Italians were always viewed as innately evil. Right. There was no, you could say like, oh, this person, you know, from this ethnicity, the reason they're like this is because of they were poor or because their father beat them or because of blah, blah, blah. But Italians, you didn't need an excuse or reason. They were just bad.
it's not just the Italians, though. I reckon you probably could associate, you know, Germans, Russians, you know, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, haha, German, he must be the bad
nowadays,
guy.
nowadays, well, it goes through phases as we go through things politically, you know, that sort of changes, doesn't it? Like all of a sudden it was like everybody who was Russian was bad.
Yeah.
And then it was everybody who's from the Middle East, bad. You know? And now they're trying to find different ways. It was, they always have this sort of English baddie. English baddie. But that's just been around for centuries, you know.
I think Colin Firth screws that one up because, you know, sometimes he acts like a baddie.
Yeah.
Because he's not very humorous and he's like, but then he's always the good guy in real life. You know?
I know. He's such a sweet person. Yeah, so I think that was the primary obstacle for me. And it's really just a matter of getting roles that are going to allow you to show, you know, the variety that you have as an actor. And then being really tough on yourself in a way and saying, no, I'm not going to take that role. I'd rather go get a job in a restaurant.
Right.
You know, or something like that. But really the thing is being able to show the diversity and being fun, being able to be funny makes a big difference. To be able to go back and forth between being funny and, you know, something that's dramatic or whatever, that starts to open people's minds.
Have you sort of regretted turning down a part that you kind of, for those reasons, for saying like that's too sort of stereotypical of me?
Never, and then, never. No, because there's no redeeming qualities there.
Right.
You know, you might have made some money or something, but it's not worth it.
It's very similar to business, though, isn't it, Mike?
Oh, I don't know. There's a few deals I wish I'd have done that I hadn't done.
And yeah.
Really? Like buying Zoom shares would have been one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello.
Especially, jeez. I put, do you know what they did to me though the other day? Like they gave me like a live streaming, yeah? So I was like, wow, they've given me live streaming for free. So then I started live streaming on Facebook, yeah? And it lasted like 4 minutes. And I was like, that's so good. I've got to do it again. And I kept live streaming, right? And then I upgraded. Like, I mean, who wouldn't, right?
then they get the money out of you.
Yeah, it's another 40 quid a month. I mean.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. But worth every penny. How much fun is it to just push live on YouTube and talk about something really interesting? It's great.
I'm afraid of what will come out of my mouth.
do you do much theatre work?
I don't believe you.
do you do much theatre work, Ben?
Because I haven't done a play. I directed a play on Broadway about 8 years ago, 8-9 years ago. But I was doing plays, but I haven't done a play now for 15 years.
Oh, wow.
Because I had kids, and you have this, everybody thinks, well, you do a play, you know, you work a few hours a night, and you know, that's it. It's like, no, it's the complete opposite. It's the most tiring thing somebody can do. Mm. And people don't realize how sort of labor intensive it is. You know, you're doing this heightened thing for 3 hours a night, whatever it is. But you don't just walk in there and kind of, you know, there you go. You know, you sort of mentally start preparing, even though you don't know you are preparing, at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm. And then suddenly, and then by the time you do the play, you eat after the play, you go to bed, you know, or you're at 1 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is. And you have to sleep, like you have to get your sleep because you're doing 8 performances a week. Mm. So you'll have your weekend. You don't have a weekend, at least the way it's structured in New York. So you do your Friday night show, Saturday matinee, Saturday night show, Sunday matinee. Mm. You don't see your family. You don't put your kids to bed. You can't wake up with them in the morning. You don't take them to school. And it's just like, so yeah, once I had a family, I was like, I'm not. And I've talked to other actors about this. You know, Emma Thompson, she's like, oh God, I can't stand it. I'll never do it again. My friend Meryl Streep didn't do a play I didn't do a play for 20 years because of your kids, because you can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but I love doing it. But it's still to this day, there are times when it's like 7:30, which is half hour in New York, right? Half hour, your show's at 8, they call half hour. So here, usually your shows start about 7:30.
Yeah.
Around 7:30, I sometimes get this slight anxiety because I think I have to, you know, go on. I'm going to go on stage. And then I realize I don't have to. I can just. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I've heard about you. He's been drinking. Right, my friend Adam. I interviewed Adam yesterday, actually, because he's furloughed at the moment. Big shout to Adam when he listens to this. But he said he's noticed that you were drinking a Negroni, yeah, and it's Campari gin, soda, and something else, right? I'm not
no,
quite
no sure. soda. I mean, some people put it in it, but
okay,
sweet vermouth.
Yeah, big problem though. He seemed to think that you should have stirred it and not shaken it. And there was an uproar on Instagram, apparently, about this.
Yes. but
so you got here basically because of the slight tingle in the stomach. You're figuring that that's because of the dodgy Negroni, not because of the fizz.
Yeah. I happen to like my Negronis up rather than on the rocks. So traditionally, you make it on the rocks and you give it a stir. You keep it on the rocks.
Okay.
I thought, well, I'd like to, I started experimenting with just doing it up just to see what it looked like in a coupe. And it was really cool looking. And you put that slice of orange in, it's really beautiful, like the red and the orange. And then you cook it.
And that sounds good to me.
Yeah, well, the flavors come together more.
Okay. Well, I know. Well,
tell Adam, you know, I'm sorry to insult him, but, you know. I was drinking it, not him. You shouldn't worry.
There's no way I'm going to argue with you about with the cocktails, because I've been checking out a few stories, and Yeah, you know your stuff on that one. So I'll leave that for Shalina to talk to you about later on.
Why? So how long have you been doing this podcast?
Well, this is my new one. But I've been podcasting nearly 5 years now.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And Mike was on my first show back then. And unfortunately me and my business partner, he went one way and I went the other, and all the content, basically he said, oh, I moved web host and it all disappeared and blah, blah, blah. So I just took Mike's episode. I said, look, Mike, sorry about this, but I'm going to put this on a new show. and I put it on a new show. And then I wasn't really happy with the brand. So then I created another brand, which is better, which is more of a business technology kind of show. But this one is called Positive Personal Power.
And, what were you doing before you did podcasts?
Social media marketing. But before that I was in the booze industry, in the wine industry.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Good person to know, really.
Thank you.
now we've got Stan interviewing you now.
I mean, I know. I was thinking, hold on, this is all wrong.
I like asking questions.
I do have more questions though, Stan.
Ask me.
Why don't you go with another question?
Give me some.
I've got one, right? So when you played George Harvey in The Lovely Bones, right? You said, I never wanted to play a serial killer. I don't like to watch things about serial killers or kids getting hurt. I can't stand that, really. But this was something beyond that. It was an exploration of loss and hope. And I'm glad that I chose to do it. So can you expand on that? Because that I read that earlier and I was like, that's interesting.
Well, because it wasn't, the movie wasn't, I didn't feel that, there was nothing gratuitous in the movie. I didn't think, at least in the script. I thought it was it's a beautiful book and it was a beautifully written script. And it is about how to deal with that how to deal with loss and you know, sort of through a not magical realism, but sort of through a fantastical way in a way. Yeah. But there's some hard reality too in it, in the film.
I found it very difficult to watch.
Yeah, it's tough. I can't watch it
because you know that the narrative from the grave is something that's kind of a very unusual way of telling a story. I don't know if it's been done before, but I haven't experienced it. And it was a very, very difficult thing because you know the inevitability of it, but it's really hard to go through that process.
No, especially with a kid.
Yeah.
You know, she was.
Absolutely.
Or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But that kid, who now is a woman, she was just an incredible actress.
Mm.
So I think that's a huge part of why that movie works.
Is because you were nominated for an Oscar in that one,
yeah,
weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you played your
part. Yeah. I couldn't wait till that. That was a hard one. I that was the hardest role I've ever played.
Mm.
I wouldn't do that again. It's too disturbing.
No, it is.
But the story was important.
Did you have to psych yourself up to get through those days?
Oh my God, yeah. I dreaded going to work every day. And it went on for months and months and months. A couple of months in Pennsylvania, I was shooting, and then we took a big break, like a 6-week break over Christmas, and then we went to New Zealand for 5 weeks. So you sort of have to keep it in there the whole time, you know, a little bit.
Where did you go in New Zealand then?
We were in Wellington, which is where Peter Jackson, who directed it, that's where he lives and has his studios and stuff.
Super.
So we were there in Wellington, which I really liked. And I was very lucky that my family came with me, my late wife, and the kids were little at the time, and my father-in-law came. And that made it really, you know, so if you're with your family, you know, it just makes it a little bit easier.
Did you feel that kind of, I don't call it depression, but that kind of weight transferred beyond the set into your sort of home, into your real world, into your kind of personal life at the time?
At first, yeah, and then I was able to cut it off. So what really helped was because I sort of tried to, you know, I made physical changes. I wore like a kind of little fat suit almost, just to give myself a bit of a belly, and then teeth made and a mustache, a wig put on. We changed, you know, put makeup on it to make my skin lighter, put contact lenses in. So you're transforming yourself. So that once you put that stuff on and you look in the mirror, you're not looking at you. You're talking differently. You know. But as soon as they said the day was over, you know, they called rep, that stuff came off so fast, and I couldn't wait to get it off. And I'd have a martini with the head makeup artist, Peter King, who's an incredible guy. And everything would go away. And then it starts, of course, the next day starts all over again. But
I wonder if, you know, so the kids are working from home at the moment, can't go into school. And I wonder whether the concept is similar with the teachers are saying to the kids, you know, in this kind of list of things they had to do when they first started lockdown was in the morning, get up at the same time, you know, go for your shower, get your breakfast, get dressed. Don't lounge around in pajamas. So it's almost like that the whole act of presenting yourself in a certain way allows you to be that person that you need to be at that time. And it's almost a similar sort of aspect of kind of you're almost like dressing into a shape that allows you to be that, and then taking
that's,
it all off.
That's what we do. Yeah, we put on our clothes, we go out into the world, we have a persona.
Yeah.
You know, and then when we come home, you know, people will instantly just change their shoes. You know, on the old classic of putting a smoking jacket and a pipe in it, you know, you're a different person, you know.
Well, you've been quite used to wearing wigs and stuff, right? But I'm surprised they even bothered to put wigs on you. Weren't you voted like eighth sexiest bald man or something?
Was I?
Yeah, there was a big thing about you. There was a big thing though. Adam said that these women were like talking about your biceps on Instagram the other day.
Yeah. I know, it's weird. It became that cocktail video. There were lots of sexual comments. I did not expect at all.
Well, I think they're all obviously justified. You've got a certain following there if you wanted to get into
some sort of, I know.
Tom Cruise remake.
Like a sex worker for alcoholics or something.
I was tempted a few years ago. What's that, Mike?
Okay, you go down your route and I'll go down. Come on, Nat, give us another.
I've got one.
How
did you overcome, right, your emotions when you're going through these struggles? Obviously, martinis probably helped, yeah? But apart from martinis, how do you overcome these struggles that you have in your life for the past however many years?
I'm not sure that they're relevant, specific ones he's referring to, but generally.
No, just in general, yeah.
In general, you have to rely on the people that you love, and that's the key thing. You know, a friend of mine is starting this big mental health initiative in America, Kenneth Cole. You know, he is the designer, and, you know, he's very altruistic, and he was the head of AMFAR for quite a while, and he's starting this thing called the Mental Health Coalition now to help destigmatize mental health and to put, you know, to encourage people to talk to others about their anxiety or what might be mental illness or whatever. And I think that for me, that's the key thing with anything, because, you know, after like my first wife passed away, that was very, very hard to deal with. And the people who helped me were my friends and my family. You know, and you just gotta talk about it.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, they were more helpful than any therapist, or in a strange way, they were more helpful, you know.
Why do you think that is, that people, because you often find that people that are close to you, people say that it's not as easy to talk to them as it is to a sort of a stranger, as a therapist.
I don't know. I really think it depends on the situation.
Mm.
You know, I found that when I did talk to a therapist or about my wife dying, I found that there was just a lot of generalities that you could read in a book, you know, the stages of grief, and you go, yeah, I know that. Like, you sort of know it.
Yeah.
But to talk personally about somebody who knew her, who, you know, who knows you for years and years, in that case, it was really important. In other cases, no, not, it's good to talk to somebody professionally, I think.
But. I guess. It's good to talk to somebody generally, and you know, if you don't have that support structure around your family and great yeah. friends, then obviously the professionals are there as well. But
yeah.
you know, if you can talk, that's the main thing, isn't it?
It is. And I also think that, you know, like we were talking about before, a kind of structure, you know, like you go in, you put the makeup on, you do the thing, you become the thing, it comes off, and you have your separate. I think that structure is absolutely crucial. You know, it's like people who raise kids and they think, well, I don't want to say no to them. And you're like, well, that's stupid. I mean, that's stupid. Why would you not say no? My parents, the first word out of their mouths was no.
Yeah. And then what's the question?
And then dad, no. You know, but.
Same.
Hey, mom, can I? No. No. But I think that I think that structure is super, super. Creating a structure for yourself and maintaining a structure for yourself all the time is important, but especially during times of grief, times of difficulty. Exercise is without question the single most important thing you can do for yourself by yourself.
That is
absolutely crucial on so many levels, you know. And then just doing, you know, if you're by yourself and you're suffering, and what, you know, I really do believe cooking is a great way to.
Well, I mean, you'll be answering a few more questions about that a little bit
later. Oh yeah, later. Yeah.
But one thing in your film, the big night, which you directed, produced. You wrote
it,
and in it as well. One thing we managed to watch it the other night, and one thing that I really, the warmth of the family between the two brothers came through on everything. They were almost like twins in the way that they operated. You know, you could see the dance that they did around a table at one point, where they were doing things to the same table around. But the thing at the end of it, where you made it. You made a scrambled egg. The scene was basically you made the scrambled eggs or omelette, whatever, for the assistant in the kitchen. And what wasn't apparent straight away for many people, I guess, it got me straight away, was you left a little bit in the pan. Mm-hmm. And what transpired was you knew that the brother was going to come in and have that third piece. So you were always making three.
Or he hopes that the brother's going to
come. Or he hopes it, yeah. But it was very, you know, the whole thing was very, the connection between the brothers was very strong. And it was very family orientated.
Yeah. Cool. I mean, to me, that's really, really important. And I think that what we tried to show in that too is that, you know, the brothers never touch each other. Except for at the end of the
last scene where they put their arm around each other,
which is the complete opposite of what you see in most Italian movies about Italians.
Yeah.
Italians, yes, they can be emotional. They can be, you know, sort of and physical, but I think people would be very surprised how in some ways taciturn and reserved many Italians are.
You can see that.
You can be passionate about something, but you might not necessarily like. My parents were really never physically affectionate with me. I mean, I knew that they loved me, and you know, but only in a time of maybe crisis or something, but they were, nobody was hugging each other all the time. I was the one who would be hugging more than, you know.
Well, I think that's not a bad place to end. I think on this particular one is a hug from Stanley.
Well, this is really fun. Thank you.
It's been fantastic.
It's just a free meander through some thoughts, and hopefully if people can take some positives out of it, then it'll be helpful.
Well, great. Well, thank you. That's nice to meet you, man.
Thank you. And how do we find Mrs. Tobin's show? Because you're going to be on that as well, right? So
I am. Absolutely.
She's at Poshnosh Gal on Instagram. That's G-A-L at the end, Poshnosh Gal. And she's been interviewing a bunch of chefs lately. She did Sean Ranking yesterday. And so you're in good company, Stan.
I know that. Didn't she do Michelle Roux or something?
Michelle Roux. She's done Atul Kucha, Vivek Singh, lots of different people. And she's building up. And this is only since the lockdown, because she's been wanting to sort of help the industry generally, because, you know, they're having a really tough time.
And I
don't know when they're going to come out of it, because when life gets back to normal for many of us, I think they're still going to be struggling.
I know.
But anyway, let's hope it's sort of, look on the positive sides, and let's hope this helps them whether they're sort of remote delivering now, which they are, or doing lots and lots of Instagram videos like you're doing as well.
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Positive Personal Power. Do subscribe via your favorite podcasting app, and please leave us a 5-star review. Or sign up on our website, positivepersonalpower.net, for weekly emails and updates, and do share our episodes with your friends and on social media. Feel free to reach out anytime.